Well, we have a number of visitors this morning that may be here because of the baby dedications, or maybe you just came to visit. Whatever the case, we welcome you. Glad that you're with us today. The rest of you probably know that in the past couple of years or so, we've been trying to give the Old Testament a little more attention, and this formally started with an extended series on the Pentateuch back in 2021 and 2022, and since then we've had a few one-parters, like Josh Birch's sermon on genealogies and my message on Balaam and so on. And in a couple years or so, we hope to do a survey of the Old Testament books of history. And there's 12 of these, not counting the five books of the Pentateuch, from Joshua to Esther. They make up the bulk of the Old Testament. And then eventually, we'd like to do a survey of the prophets and the minor prophets as well. Maybe a little ambitious, but that's kind of on our to-do list. And we've had a lot of discussion on how would be the best way to approach all of this. And in those discussions, it became evident that there are a number of topics about the Old Testament that we should try to deal with first. And we've been compiling a list of those, and the plan is to cover a few of them yet this summer, but most of them we'll be dealing with next year. So for the next couple months, I'll be taking about 5 weeks or so to cover just some basic background information, information that should prove helpful for the material that we will eventually be covering, and also helpful for just your own personal reading of the Old Testament. Which brings up the question, are we reading the Old Testament? So how many, like, read through the Old Testament, say, once a year? Oh, wow, it's great. Perfect. All right. How many try to read from the Old Testament at least two or three times a week, and not counting Psalms and Proverbs, but, you know, okay. All right, good. How many would categorize it as I'm kind of hit and miss when it comes to the Old Testament? Some of you are being honest. How many are willing to admit that you seldom, if ever, read from the Old Testament? Okay, how many would admit that you seldom read from the New Testament? All right, I got a couple people. All right. So with the Old Testament, it seems that a good place to start here when we're just talking about the basic level here would be a simple timeline, a basic timeline, a broad overview of the Old Testament's chronology. And I'm sure most of us along the way have seen such timelines. We've been taught them, and we are generally familiar with the sequence of most events, but some might not be. And a little bit of review for all of us certainly wouldn't hurt. And one of the reasons that some of the chronology in the Old Testament tends to be fuzzy is because in our Bibles, books are grouped together by genre and not so much laid out in chronological order. You know, the account of the last events are described in the final chapter of Nehemiah. But in our Bibles, Nehemiah is placed in the first half of the Old Testament. You know, there's 23 books that come after it. So we'll spend just a few minutes on chronology this morning, and then we'll continue to revisit it in the coming weeks. And following this, in part two for today, I want to talk about the differences in our two cultures. This is kind of a big subject. We often fail to appreciate what is going on in a passage because we are reading it through the lens of our own culture, and we do this without even realizing it. We naturally assume that other societies function a lot like our own, but they often don't. So this morning is basically two parts, chronology and culture. And using clever speech-making tricks, both start with the same letter. All right, there you go. So what's that?
Sorry, nice touch.
Nice touch, yeah. I did it without even trying.
I know.
and when you try, it really does look like you tried. So just to kind of give you a heads up, this is going to be one of those, grunt work sermons. You know, this is going to be more educational. It's not going to be all that exciting or inspirational, that sort of thing. But yet, all this stuff is going to be very important. So we're all on the same page so far? All right, good. All right, so let's start with chronology, and we'll launch into this with one of the things I really like to do, and that is with a little quiz. And we just love quizzes here, all of us do, and it's been a long time since we've had one. So this will be pretty simple. Who came first? All right, David, Noah, or Abraham? All right, who came first? Samuel, David, or Isaiah? Didn't sound very confident. Samuel, all right. Saul, King Saul, Moses, or Joseph? Okay. Jeremiah Jacob Isaac. Isaac. Samson, Solomon, Ezra. Ezra of the Old Testament, not our Ezra. Okay. Samson. All right. Elijah, Aaron, Jonathan. Everybody's kind of like mumbling here, right? Aaron. All right. We have Ruth, Esther, Jezebel. Don't want to leave out the women. Ruth. All right. And one more. This will be the easiest one. We have Mishbam, Mishma, or Shaw. All right. This is found in the fine print in one of the genealogies and chronicles. So this would actually be Shaul, who's the son of Simeon, who's the son of Jacob. The other two guys are grandsons. All right. So I generally find timelines helpful, but oftentimes they include, when you look at them, so much detail that you can kind of get lost in all the information. So I prefer to start with something very basic and simple and then just fill things in as needed or along the way, kind of like go up 10 or 20,000 feet, so to speak, and try to see the main events, the main turning points, or better yet, even the major blocks of time, the periods of time. So see if you can relate to this. This is something that I kind of struggled with throughout the years. In Sunday school, you know, we are told the stories of David and Goliath and Jonah and the big fish and the walls of Jericho falling and the strong man Samson and so on. We all know those stories. They're fun and exciting, and those stories stick with us. We remember them, but to a large degree, they and others are just stories scattered throughout the Old Testament. We don't really know how they fit together or where they belong in the larger picture of redemption history, and we don't always know which stories and events are of primary importance and which ones are more secondary. You know, the story about Samson and his long hair and great strength, I mean, it's a great story. It's a fun one to read, but it's not nearly as significant in Israel's history as that of Israel dividing up into two separate kingdoms. But most of us know more about Samson. You know, how many of us can even name the two major players in Israel's division and what that division was all about? Many here could, but I would guess that a number would not be able to. The story of Jonah is also a great one as well, but again, it hardly pales with the time God made a covenant with Abraham, and which is very significant, and yet most of us know more about the story of Jonah getting swallowed up by a fish than we do about the time God made a covenant with Abraham and all that was involved in that covenant and all that was significant in that whole event there. So these are just a couple examples. So part of our overall task in our Old Testament studies is to sort out the people and events that are of primary importance from people and events that are more secondary. And as mentioned earlier, to see how everything fits together in a sequential order. And, you know, again, this is just basic information that all of us really should know. So let's jump into it here with the timeline. For today, I'm just going to enumerate seven major periods, seven blocks of time. These are going to be easy to remember, and just like for them to be permanently embedded in our in all of our brains. And you know, like take that little quiz that we just did. If we could match each person with the respective time period, then it becomes pretty easy to map things out in a chronological order. And it's not always essential, just to say this, it's not always essential to be precise. Generally speaking, it's enough to know who goes with what. For example, it's more important to remember the time period that the story of Ruth belongs to than the events that preceded or followed it. Does that make sense? For the most part. All right. And just a quick note here on this graphics. This is not according to scale. Some of those periods can be quite long and others are relatively short. All right. So the first period, we could just call the beginnings. This is pretty simple. We have the creation account, Adam and Eve and the fall, all the way up to Noah and the flood. Next would be the period of the patriarchs. This starts with Abraham, the father of the Jews, his son Isaac, his son Jacob, chosen by God over Esau, and Jacob's 12 sons, the 12 patriarchs of the 12 tribes of Israel. And this period extends from Abraham to Moses and the Exodus out of Egypt. Third, we could just call this sojourn, conquest, settlement. We start with the giving of the Ten Commandments, more or less, the 40 years of wandering in the desert, Joshua and Caleb, and the advancements upon Canaan, the era of the judges who governed Israel once they settled in the Promised Land. Next, we have the United Kingdom. So this would be, start with King Saul, then King David, then King Solomon, and all the events that are described in those books there, 1st and 2nd Samuel. All right, followed by the divided monarchy. Upon Solomon's death, his son Rehoboam leads with a heavy hand, and as a result, 10 of the 12 tribes reject him as king, decide to do their own thing. They reside in the northern part of the land, retain the name Israel, and their first king was Jeroboam. Meanwhile, Solomon's son Rehoboam presides over the southern kingdom, which includes the tribe of Judah and Benjamin. And the southern kingdom was commonly referred to as Judah, and it included a key city, and that city would be Jerusalem. All right. Next, we have the exile. The northern kingdom, Israel, falls to the Assyrians. They are taken captive. Many are deported to Assyria and are assimilated into its culture. Assyrians were cruel, ruthless, so resistance is futile, all right? And when you hear the Assyrians referred to, you should just think of the Borg from Star Trek. I mean, it's like that. You're just assimilated into them, and they're very cruel. 130 years later, the southern kingdom, Judah, falls to the Babylonians. Many are deported to Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar orders Solomon's temple to be ransacked and destroyed. In both cases, these deportations did not happen all at once, not an overnight thing, consisted of a series of them over a period of time, and they did not include the entire population. Many Jews were deported, but not all. The conquerors usually took all the rulers and leaders along with young, healthy men and left behind most of the women, children, the elderly, the sick, and feeble. All right, number seven, the last period here would be the return from exile to the homeland. And here we are primarily talking about captives taken from the southern kingdom, Judah. The Persians had now conquered both the Assyrians and the Babylonians, and its king, King Cyrus, permits Jews to return to their land. And this takes place in three main stages stretched out over a period of about 100 years. And the second period also includes what historians refer to as the Second Temple Judaism or post-exilic Judaism. Under the leaders like Ezra and Nehemiah, Israel was reestablished, rebuilt, settles back into their homeland. God's law is rediscovered, read before the people. Everyone eagerly commits themselves to it. Solomon's temple is being rebuilt. And again, the last of these events described in the Old Testament are those recorded in the final chapter of Nehemiah. And after this, we go into what we call the intertestament period, 400 years between the Old Testament and New Testament, and that's on our list to cover at some point as well. That's a lot of history takes place there that we should be familiar with. So a quick note on the rebuilding of Solomon's temple. They try to duplicate his temple the best they could, but it turns out really to be a modest copy, you might say. Not really all that impressive, but it serves the purpose. Centuries later, it is given a complete makeover under who? King Herod gives it a complete makeover, and then in what year is it utterly destroyed by the Romans? 70. There you go. So again, this is just a very basic timeline. Others, you might see others divided up differently, which is okay. Think of this as like building shelves in your garage. It doesn't matter how many shelves you have or how big they are. What matters is that you know what goes on what shelf. So for the most part, it's kind of the same thing with timelines. For instance, we could easily make the 100-year period of the Jews returning from exile a separate block here. I didn't because there isn't that much in the Old Testament that talks about that, and I chose to err on the side of just keeping it short and simple. So we will revisit this often. Next week, we'll have time here to match these seven periods with the books in the Old Testament to show what books cover what, and eventually we'll be filling this in with some people and events. All right? Sound good? So next week, I'll expect everyone to take out a blank sheet of paper. Well, I'll give you 2 weeks to be able to do this. Blank sheet of paper, write down these seven periods in order. And really, if our kids can memorize, what, like 30 verses, we should be able to handle seven simple points, correct? Everybody says, Where's the unity of the faith here? I mean, where's... All right, let's now move into part two. Who remembers the second point of today? We have chronology and, starts with the C, culture. But I see the short-term memory in this church is pretty good. All right. All right. In the past, we have talked about how important it is to appreciate the differences between the culture of the ancient world and our own. We talk about this often. When we read certain narratives, we can fail to appreciate the dynamic of what's going on, even miss the point altogether, because reading them from our own frame of reference, we are projecting, even in the most subtle ways, our own familiarities upon the situation being described. Even though we know intellectually that the cultures are different, it is still just natural for us to assume that other societies function a lot like our own, and we do this without even realizing it. So one example of this is the situation with Judah's son Onan, and we'll get into that story next week. But people often come to certain conclusions about Onan's sin that are just completely off the mark. The story has been used to preach against a certain act of sexual immorality and even birth control and contraception and so on. But the situation with Onan has little, if anything, to do with any of that. And many in modern times miss this because, one, we live in a sexually permissive culture, and so this is something that just naturally is high on our radar. We're alert to these kinds of things. And we simply do not have a good grasp of certain family obligations that were honored back then, even commanded by God, obligations that would, quite frankly, seem really strange to us and probably objectionable. And so most people just read through the text and assume certain things, and like other passages, they assume a lot of things wrongly. One way that has helped me to appreciate just how real these differences in our cultures are and how challenging it can be to cut through them is to visualize two fish aquariums, one on each side of the room, say 12 or 15 feet apart. Each one is populated by a different species of fish. Each one has its own unique plants, decorative gravel on the bottom, various ornaments, and so on. Even the shape of the glass aquarium itself is different, different lighting, and so on. The fish in one aquarium see the other aquarium, and they just assume that their world is the same as their own, and the world that they're looking at. But obviously it's not, and so it is with us. We are like goldfish in a bowl looking at other goldfish in their bowl. And the view is not all that clear, and it's foggy at best. And there is a lot that separates us. And try as we may, we simply cannot duplicate all the sights, sounds, and smells. We can climb into their world only so much. We have a language gap, a historical gap, a cultural gap, a geological gap, and very important, a philosophical gap. Very big. Even something as basic as mountains can be an issue when you think about this. Someone who lives in Colorado, who in their reading of the Bible comes across a reference to mountains, is probably going to have a completely different picture in his head than what the author had. Because the highest mountain in Colorado is 14,400 feet. The highest mountain in Israel is five times smaller at only 2,800 feet. So big difference, you know, but the differences go much deeper here. They involve far more than the landscape or the clothes they wore, or the food they ate, or the way they moved about from village to village, you know, donkeys instead of cars. There are philosophical differences and differences regarding values and priorities and honor and family and so on. And so for today and next week, we're going to look at one of those, and it's a pretty big one. Anyone want to guess what that might be? I want to take a guess at it. Who wants to take a stab at it? All right, for those who are listening on the MP3, I've just put up a slide that says Israel's tribal culture, and nobody has responded to it yet. So I want to take a guess on what a big difference in our culture might be. Yes, they're tribal. Yes, all right. And when you think tribal, don't think Indians and that kind of thing. I mean, tribal culture. All right. So, to speak candidly, many parts of their tribal culture can seem really strange to us, but we need to be pretty familiar with it if we're going to understand the Old Testament, and to some degree even the New Testament, but especially the Old, for it comes into play in many of the narratives. the way families live together, and how all that was structured, and the obligations that all of this entailed. Again, very different than how we do things in the modern world here in the West. So let's get into it. First, ancient Israel was a patriarchal society, more or less the natural result of belonging to one of the 12 tribes. So as you were taught in Sunday school, the nation of Israel consists of 12 different tribes. So we start with Abraham, who's regarded as the father of the Jews. Abraham is promised a son, Isaac. Isaac has two sons, Jacob and Esau. Though the youngest of the two, Jacob secures both the blessing and birthright of the firstborn. Jacob has 12 sons, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, Gad, Asher, Dan, Naphtali, Joseph, and Benjamin. And these 12 sons are the 12 patriarchs of the 12 tribes that make up the nation of Israel. I think we all remember that, right? We all know how that works. Jacob had one daughter, Dinah, but she never became a head of any tribe, only the sons, only men, thus patriarchal. Okay, that brings us now to clans and households. And this would be the foundation of Israel's society. As to be expected, over the course of time, each of these 12 tribes grew in population. Eventually, all 12 patriarchs die, and successive generations bring about their grandchildren and great-grandchildren, great-great-grandchildren, and so on and so on. Within these tribes are clans, more or less adult cousins sharing a common grandfather or great-grandfather. And within these clans are households, what we might refer to as extended families. And within these households are nuclear families, mom, dad, and the kids. So the head of the household is the oldest living man of that family. And depending on how old you are, he might be your father, your grandfather, or even your oldest brother. And the word patriarch itself simply means male head of a family, clan, or tribe. So what we have here are certain layers of society based on the oldest male member of the family. And you are who you are is largely determined by all of this. And we'll come back to that in a little bit. So in this arrangement, the household is foundational, and so we need to take a moment here to describe it. There's a certain Hebrew term used to refer to it, and that literal translation of it is father's house. But to keep things simple, we'll just refer to it as household. So, for the sake of the illustration, I've got graphics today. I spent a lot of time on this. You need to appreciate it. For the sake of the illustration, let's picture a father and his wife. And he has, say, seven sons and three daughters. The daughters are in dresses and they're in pink, just to be very clear. And five of those sons are married and have children. The daughters, however, are not married, and this would be a household. There might be 20 or 30 people in this arrangement, up to three generations. And in this scenario, we would have six nuclear families, you might say, in a community living situation. They're all related. One of those nuclear families would be the top parents and the two unmarried sons and the three daughters, and then, of course, the five nuclear families of the sons who are married. All of them would share together the same living compound. That, you know, they'd farm the same land. They'd share together in the same produce. They'd raise the same livestock. They work together. They live together, all under the head of the house, a patriarch. And each family would have their own living quarters. This isn't a dormitory, but depending on the situation, that might consist of separate tents or separate quarters in a house. But everyone would, of course, be in close proximity. The women would share together the chores of washing and cooking and cleaning, and the children would pitch in as well accordingly. If the father passed away, his oldest son would fill his role as the patriarch. And if the household grew too large to sustain it, it would split up. It all depended on the size of the family and the situation itself. Okay, now we can imagine that this arrangement was very efficient. There would be one lawnmower, not six, one snowblower, one generator. Besides that, of sharing resources, another big advantage was that it provided a better level of security and protection. A home with six or eight burly guys can better defend themselves than a home with just one. And this was important when it came to the threat of Canaanite neighbors. On the other hand, we can also imagine quite easily that there could be problems, tensions within the home. And this is a natural thing to expect when working and living together. Tensions between the kids, tensions between the parents, tensions even with the patriarch, who probably made all sorts of decisions that would have been unpopular with everybody else. And we can see a little bit of this in some of the Old Testament narratives. But for the most part, the ancient Israelites made it work. Community living doesn't seem to work very well in our culture. And this is more or less a commentary on us than the arrangement itself. Our culture, of course, fosters personal freedom and independence. Again, this is a big philosophical difference. And, you know, we just end up, as a result, being too fussy, too hard to please, and we really do cherish our personal space. And so today it's not that uncommon for kids to leave the home at 18 or 21 and relocate 200 miles away and get a job there. But not back then. They wouldn't even locate 2 miles away, nor would you choose your own occupation. You were born into your occupation. So when the patriarch would die or the household became too large, whatever the situation might be, it would split up into new households, each headed by now the oldest living male of that household. And these new households would be part of the same clan, lots of aunts and uncles and cousins, second cousins, third cousins, all of whom shared a common ancestor, great-grandfather, for instance. And there would be obligations within these clans. A good example of this is what we've seen with Abraham and Lot. You might remember the land could not sustain both of them, and so Abraham's household divided into two. Later, Lot is captured by a coalition of kings. Abraham gathers a mighty army of 318 warriors, chases down those kings, rescues his nephew. And he did this because, yes, he was a good guy, but also because of the principles embedded in that culture. If a member of your clan needed to be ransomed or rescued, you were expected to do something about it. Okay, so in this tribal culture, what about women? Well, a few comments here. As you probably know, when a woman married, she left her household, joined the household of her husband. She literally, we say this today, but it really meant something back then. She literally married into his family. You know, and she came under a new and different head of household, a patriarch. And that might be your husband's father or grandfather or even his oldest brother. And this would be a big change for her. This would be a big adjustment. It's hard for us to imagine this sort of thing. So imagine having to learn all the new ways that this other household did things. And as an outsider coming in, learning how to get along with the siblings and all their wives, and with all the siblings of your husband and all their and the wives of those siblings. And again, this is, they're getting together more than just visits at Thanksgiving, which we sometimes find difficult, but they're living together and working together day in and day out. Not to mention that the dynamics of leaving your mom and coming under the oversight of a mother-in-law and having to cook and clean according to her standards. So marriage would be a huge change. You know, husband comes into your life, you have a new household, living with an extended family, new patriarch, new matriarch. But women were not neglected. If one of the husbands or household died, leaving his wife a widow, it fell on the patriarch to make sure that she would be provided for. And this generally consisted of arranging a marriage for her. But she would be provided for one way or the other. And this brings us then to the next topic, the significance of the firstborn son. Again, this is different than how we do things today. And it's a major thing in many of the Old Testament narratives and something that we have to be alert to. In Israel's tribal society, the firstborn son would, of course, assume the role of patriarch upon his father's death and would actually receive a double portion of the inheritance of the family estate, and this so that he would have the resources necessary to maintain the well-being of the household. And during his lifetime, he would be expected to shadow his father, serve as an apprentice in all of his duties. Much more was expected of him than the other siblings. The significance of the firstborn is seen in one of the more intriguing laws of Moses. And I'll try to illustrate this with these graphics. And I really spent a lot of time on this, way too much time on these. So you need to appreciate all the animations and cool things going on here. But try to illustrate this because it's an important point. Comes up in the Old Testament and will come up next week. If the oldest son dies, if the oldest son, of the household dies, leaving a wife and no children, then God required that another son of that household married the widow and produce children.
Whoa.
Look at that, huh? And they've got their children. All right. I finally did something that people appreciated after 23 years here. All right. The oldest son of this new marriage would legally be the son of the deceased brother. Okay, this would be his firstborn son. Okay, so and there's the deceased brother. All right, so So you have to keep this all straight now. Biologically, this is actually an uncle-nephew relationship, but legally, it is a father-son relationship. As you know, talking about this firstborn child to the brother of his father. Everyone following that? See, it's biologically an uncle-nephew relationship, but legally it's a father-son relationship. And as the firstborn son, he will, when he comes of age, receive all the appropriate blessings and responsibilities, namely the inheritance of his estate and become the patriarch of that household. All right, this now brings us to another significant difference, the way people are identified. So a tribal society like that of ancient Israel's, you are identified by three main factors: your patriarch, your gender, and your birth order. You know, what household do you belong to? Are you male or female? Wasn't much confusion back then about that. And if male, are you the firstborn? Okay. Well, there is today sometimes. See? So, you know, what household do you belong to? Male or female? And if you're male, are you the firstborn? And once someone knows who the head of your household is, they could place you in your particular clan, and more importantly, which of the 12 patriarchs or which of the 12 tribes that you belong to. So these are the layers of Israel society, and each individual would identify their place in society accordingly. Tribe, clan, household is how you identified others and how others identified you. And this is one of the reasons why we have so much emphasis on genealogies in the Old Testament. It establishes who a person is, their legal rights and inheritance, and their place in the nation itself. It's not to determine how important you are. It's simply the way to show people how you are identified. And this, of course, is altogether different than how we do things in the modern West. Altogether different. For instance, in the small town of Markle, you know, where I live, people would know me as the son of John and Betty Brain, but that is as far as it goes when it comes to lineage. They wouldn't have a clue about my grandparents or great-grandparents. And none of that would mean anything, especially since none of them lived in the Markle area anyway. And the fact that I'm the son of John and Betty would just be a piece of information that would, you know, but they would mostly identify me by other things. You know, they would know me as someone who pastors some church up in Fort Wayne. They wouldn't know the name of it, but they just kind of vaguely know something like that. That I ride around everywhere on this crazy-looking bicycle. That I live back in the woods on Oak Road. That I used to be a brick mason and was once in the news a lot for stirring up things in front of the abortion clinic and so on. And if I were wealthy, well, that would come to mind as well. In fact, that'd be probably the first thing that would come to mind. And when I walk into the local hardware and interact with other customers who know of me, these are the sorts of things that I suspect they are thinking about. You know, they do not say to themselves, "This is Wendell, the son of John, the son of Frank, the son of Wendell, the son of Milton, the son of Peter." You know, really, do we do that? Does anyone do that? This is not where our minds naturally go, but that is how the ancient Hebrews naturally thought about it. And the fact that I can't trace my lineage back any further than Peter says a lot about the culture that has conditioned me. What difference does it make who the father of Peter was? I mean, and I don't even know if Peter had other children besides Milton. No one ever told me. I never asked. I never thought to ask. Never seemed important. It's not my culture. But an ancient Hebrew could rattle off a whole line of ancestors and their offspring. Family was everything, and family is what gave you identity. First Chronicles is filled with genealogies, tracing one's ancestors back to each of the 12 patriarchs of the 12 tribes of Israel. It's not fun to read, but it's important. It's all there for a reason. So the takeaway here is pretty clear. This strong sense of family, tribal connectedness, and obligations within one's household and clan has to be taken into account when reading Old Testament narratives. All right, another facet of this. It's 11:30 already? Okay, well, we just have to stop. I'm just kidding. Let's go. I can't believe it's 11:30 already. All right. Nobody look at your clock. Nobody knows what time it is. Just because I announced it doesn't mean a thing. All right. Another facet of this, and we need to talk a little more about, is the authority of the patriarch and his responsibilities. He was, for those under his care, responsible for everyone's economic well-being, protection, and so on, and for making sure that God's law was being obeyed. In the story about Onan, which we will get into next week, his father Judah orders him to marry his oldest brother's widow. Not just marry her, but orders her to have children with her. Now, just try to picture that for today. Can any of the guys here imagine your dad telling you who to marry? You don't have a choice in the matter. You're going to marry this person. So you do what I tell you to do. You're going to marry her. And then you're going to have kids with her. I mean, these are like the two biggest decisions in anyone's life, and someone else is making them for you. So while the patriarch would be involved in arranging a marriage, actually, they probably wouldn't get into the business of telling a couple to have children, but Judah did this because this was one of the situations where the oldest son died, leaving a widow behind with no children. But patriarchs did run the household. They were in charge of protecting it, providing for it, managing it. They took care of its legal affairs, negotiated business deals, enforced God's law within that household, arranged marriages, oversaw the farming operations, settled disputes with neighbors, resolved disputes within the household, managed income, expenses. I mean, he's the guy in charge. And he's the one who called the county to complain about increases in the property tax and so on. So that was just a joke. But whether a patriarchal society system is better or worse, that's a whole different discussion. My purpose is to simply point out the differences. And we might actually have some remnants of patriarchal culture like wives taking the last names of their husbands, but this seems to be more really of a formality and not something that actually reflects a mindset. So I could illustrate it this way. You know, dad takes the family. This is a great story. I got to make sure I got a clear voice for it. It's my favorite story of the whole sermon. Dad takes the family to the ball game, and on the way home, he throws out the question, where do you want to stop for supper, pizza or burgers or chicken? And everyone weighs in, and everyone has an equal voice. And in the end, Dad never really gets what he wants. He's usually outvoted and booed down. In fact, if he just pulled up to Chipotle's without asking everyone else, he would be considered what? A real jerk. You know, the kids would be crying and complaining about not getting the Happy Meal at McDonald's, and they'd be refusing to come into the restaurant, and his wife would be crabbing at him about being so selfish and insensitive. How can you do this, you know? Just pick out the place you want to go to without even asking, you know? So our homes really, what?
It sounds personal.
No, it's not personal. It's not personal.
Like coupons.
What?
Yeah, where are you at?
Yeah, it's where you have coupons, all right? But really, even if that illustration doesn't apply to your home, our houses do really operate a lot like little democracies, because that's our culture. What color are we going to paint the dining room? We all have to vote on it. Where do you want to go for vacation? What board games do you want to play tonight? What name should we give the new puppy? Everything's discussed. Everything's voted on. And the role of the grandparents has changed as well. You know, they have little, if any, influence. In fact, grandpa's usually shut down immediately if he tries to contribute in any way. If he offers just the smallest piece of advice on how to deal with his son's spoiled child, or offer any input on what job to accept, or what home to buy, or how to invest for the future, he is told in so many words to do what? To butt out. You know, it's our life. Stay out of it. So again, if we fail to see the influence and authority that was typically given to fathers and grandfathers in that ancient culture, we could fail to appreciate all that is going on in a particular passage, or even miss the point altogether. And we have to be careful to not read into the passage, even in a subtle way, the sorts of arrangements and attitudes that are familiar to us. So we are much more egalitarian than we think we are, and they were much more patriarchal than we think they were. All right, we will continue this next week and look at a couple narratives in the Old Testament where all of this is played out. One of those deal with Onan, but Onan only plays a minor role in the whole story. It mostly involves his father, Judah, and his sister-in-law, Tamar. So that's your assignment. Read Genesis 38, the whole chapter. Take note of and actually look for how Israel's patriarchal society shows up in that story. And how knowing that helps us to better appreciate what is going on. And parts of that chapter, parts of next week's sermon may not be appropriate for younger children, so I'm going to give it a PG-13 rating just to be safe, but most of our kids are in Sunday school anyway. So upon that note, I will have Dave Stevens come at this time and close.
Thank you, Wendell. If he hadn't given you an assignment, I was going to do that because I think I found the same was true when it comes to reading the Old Testament. I remember I had a couple sermons, my first one, and go over just an outline of the difference between Leviticus versus Deuteronomy and so on. And I was surprised how many comments I got from people about just being not just unfamiliar with it, but perhaps not even having ever read it. So a lot of the things Wendell spoke about this morning, if you really think about it, comes down to issues that might come up for us out of just basic ignorance of not spending the time on it. So I think it's a very worthwhile proposition. So we have a reading assignment, so that's great. I'd also like to make the point that I don't know if you noticed in the reading from Ephesians today and how it keeps coming up in our series on Romans is understanding the background. I mean, Christianity is obviously not independent of Judaism. And one thing we fail to understand very well is the background and how, for example, justification by faith is valid based on the background that we have. And so there's just so many layers to this. And we have the cultural talk when we talk about these things anyway, like Wendell was. What always comes to mind for me is our cultural snobbery, and we always think whatever's going on currently is the best way to do things, which is, I believe, hardly ever true. But there are certainly some good and some bad to take out of it. But if you don't know any better, then how do you even try to sift through that information and make good decisions and try to appreciate what's going on? It's very difficult to do. So I hope you appreciate all that we'll be covering, because I think there's going to be a lot that we can take away from it. So if you'd stand, I'm going to close with one of my favorite readings. Now to him who is able to do immeasurably more than we ask or imagine, according to his power that is at work within us, to him be glory in the church and in Jesus Christ throughout all generations, forever and ever. Amen. You are dismissed. Go in peace.